Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents I Am Yudin, Undercover in the SS, by Steven Uzel, narrated by Sean Patrick Hopkins. Lublin, Nazi-occupied Poland, 1941. 1. Outside, a thaw was underway. Early morning traffic had rendered the immaculate snowfall drear and gray slush. We tramped along the road, past a tobacconist's and a dry cleaner's on the corner of a dark alley. The Belarusian police headquarters was less than a mile away, but we only got as far as the shops before coming to a stop. The level crossing barrier was down. Angry, hooting traffic snarled up behind a throng of commuters in hats and long coats at the barrier. An immense, apparently endless, Deutsche Reichsbahn train press-ganged into military evacuation was stranded at the platform, soldiers leaning out the carriage windows, smoking, singing songs. Banners unfurled along the roof swore a variety of inventive deaths to the Russians. The lower-ranking passenger locomotive had been shunted onto the side tracks while the transporter was being repaired.
"It's been stuck there for 45 minutes,
a businessman blustered as we shouldered up to the barrier.
"Broken rear axle, apparently. How long do these things take to get fixed?"
"Does this look like a train driver's uniform?"
The Belarusian gendarme bristled, thumbing his chest.
Make way, police coming through."
I followed my new boss across to the station on the other side of the road, where a larger crowd had gathered. A cordon of German soldiers were guarding the station doors, preventing access. Behind them, the ticket hall was deserted. While the train was being repaired, the station facilities were reserved exclusively for the SS, en route to the Eastern Front. Regular commuters had been escorted outside to make way. Fairly smarting from the eviction, factory and office workers united in complaint. Children snaked through the dense forest of limbs, making mischief from their elders' woes. I felt a questing tug at my hip pocket and span around, ready to pounce, but the youngster had disappeared. Somewhere behind us, a woman shrieked. Bedlam was on the verge of breaking loose. I watched as the gendarme raised an arm and waved.
"Damien, Herr Plotz, here."
I was still getting used to hearing my new alias's name. The gendarme and I had become separated in the melee, but I was standing behind him, not in front. Granted, the face the gendarme was currently beseeching did bear a certain resemblance to my own, but the body shielded from view belonged to a sturdy SS officer. As soon as the gendarme thrust a hand on that studded epaulette, he realized his mistake.
"Police, sorry.
But without a translator, he was unable to explain himself, resorting to childish mime. I hung back, watching him squirm before that mighty officer, who did not appreciate being manhandled.
"My God, you're a policeman, too!"
The German raged, taking in the Belarusian's uniform.
"Captain Stripes, you can't even speak the language. No wonder this country's so absolutely fucked. Very sorry. 10 engineers dicking around and not one of them knows what to do. We've been on the rails for a day with no problems at all. Then we get to Poland and boom, the whole world grinds to a fucking halt. The payphone's out of order. The tobacconist doesn't even sell Nordlands. Then I come out here and get an earful from this rabble. A bloody disgrace after all we've done for them. If you don't get your people under control, Captain, I will."
I could stand by no longer. I stepped forward and offered my services. After I'd translated the officer's rant, the gendarme pulled a whistle to his lips to quell the crowd, then stopped and pulled me close.
"Tell him they might have some Nordlands next to the dry cleaners."
I pointed out the Tabak sign across the road. The SS officer made off without uttering another word, hurling himself forward like a ball player in a scrum. When the crowd closed again behind us, the gendarme was standing next to a group of workers in gas company caps and overalls. The shortest, meanest-looking one crossed his arms high up on his chest and said,
"If they pay you enough to take that crap, I'm in the wrong job."
His friends concurred, lowing like cattle.
"You saw his rank," the gendarme said. "What was I supposed to do?"
One of the men made a crude suggestion, and the others laughed, then formed a circle and began muttering. A loose bag underneath the gendarme's left eye twitched, as if a fly was trapped beneath the skin. He was spared further embarrassment when another spat erupted further down the line. An ejected commuter was frantically pointing across the no-man's land of concrete into the station restaurant. Few of us saw the outrage with our own eyes, but word spread like fire over harvest stubble. Two of the elite SS, after finishing their complimentary breakfast of bread and sausage, had enticed a couple of younger waitresses out from behind the grill. Proprietorial arms around thin shoulders, the officers paraded the women past the tables at the window, in full view of the evicted Poles, right through the length of the restaurant into the men's bathroom, from where they had not returned. As I strained to see into the restaurant for myself, an object whistled over my head. A plate glass window detonated behind the cordon of soldiers at the entrance. Thinking the explosion had come from within, the soldiers span around, and a second rock landed between a set of German shoulder blades, 10 inches south of denting the back of his skull. All around me, Poles were on their knees, tearing up the ground for rubble.
"There's a phone in the dry cleaners."
The gendarme scanned for reinforcements, but found only myself.
"Call the station before we're mopping up a bloodbath."
Rifles volleyed as I barged through the mob to the level crossing. I froze mid-stride, cringing. A flurry of shots, and then no more. Silence. The Germans had fired over the protesters' heads to restore order. No more missiles rained down on their cordon. An uneasy truce seemed to hold. I hopped the barrier and sprinted up the street towards the shops by the gendarme's house. Hurtling from the other direction, two young Poles swerved around me, one of them dropping an object that bounced into the gutter. I called out, but they didn't hear me and didn't stop. In the road, I kicked through slush, unearthing the leather wallet they had dropped, turned inside out, and picked clean of cash. All that remained in the wallet was a Waffen-SS identification card. It belonged to the officer the gendarme had just upset, Oberführer Harry Munke. I recognized the raging face from his photograph. I span round to face the narrow alley next to the dry cleaners. A pair of black leather boots splayed out from behind a dumpster bin. I announced myself as the gendarme's translator. No answer. Nobody else was watching us. All eyes were on the siege on the other side of the road. I crept into the gloomy alleyway and peered around the dry cleaner's bin. Oberführer Munke lay propped against the wall, ambushed before he could buy his Nordlands. One of the two fleeing youths had probably been hiding where I stood now, at the alley's entrance. His accomplice had pushed the German in. They'd fought. Munke had fallen backward or been pushed. His tunic was torn open, one missing button, his cap dislodged. The flattened back of his head was glued to the wall with a paste of blood and brain. Gagging, I stumbled away, turning towards the light. Over the stalled traffic, I could hear the futile piping of the gendarme's whistle in front of the train station. I looked back at the gleaming insignia of a senior SS colonel's gray-green tunic, the pair of oak leaves on his silver-braided collar, and that German jaw that had only 10 minutes ago been mistaken for my own. Hiding behind the dumpster, I kicked my shoes off and yanked my trousers down around my ankles. In my underpants, I tugged Munke's boots from his legs, unbuckled his belt, grabbed hold of the flared fabric at his hips, and pulled, exposing two pale white thighs, a scarred knee, and a pair of sturdy shins. The pulped remains of his head came unstuck from the wall, chin flopped down and rested against his breastbone. I pulled on the man's trousers and boots, but spent the next 5 minutes trying to stuff his feet into my shoes, which were a size smaller. Centauroid, half man, half beast, I rose to finish my transformation. From Jewish Josef Ziegler to Polish Damian Plotz, to SS Oberführer Harry Munke. I wrenched my white shirt open without popping any buttons and unfastened the man's tunic. Extricating first his left arm, then his right, I slipped the jacket from his back and peeled off his white vest, slick with sweat. Of all the man's noxious garments, it was that damp vest I could not stand to feel against my chest. I twisted it into a rag and buried it in the dumpster. His tunic fitted me well enough, a little long in the arms and a touch short at the back. Not bad, not perfect, but it would do. Almost. The only distinguishing features were Monka's nose and mouth, fleshier and closer together than my own. What a shame it was the back of the German's head his attackers had caved in and not the front. For this deception to work, I had no choice but to alter his appearance, with only the bluntest of surgical instruments at my disposal. Gripping his lapels, I pulled the body forward until it was facing the corner of the dumpster. Then I reared back on my right foot, placed my left one squarely behind his head, and stomped. The first kick met some resistance. I stomped again, bone and cartilage crunching underfoot. The third time, the center of Oberfuhrer Harry Monke's face split around the perpendicular steel edge like a watermelon under a machete. I left him embedded there, pausing only to retrieve the old woman's prayer shawl I had dropped. Back out on the street, I tugged my zip as if emerging from a sly urination for the benefit of any curious onlookers. A factory whistle blew, high and lonesome. The pavement in front of the shops was busy with the hustle of early morning workers. Nobody paid me much notice. If you saw the SS, you put your head down and kept moving. Vehicles were still stopped at the level crossing, but drivers had turned their engines back on, and not in wishful thinking. The whistle was not from any factory. Straddling the tracks, the troop transporter train was puffing steam into the cold air. The engineers had finally fixed the problem. The train was ready to leave. The quickest way out of the gendarmes' purview was on that train. All I had to do was get to Lublin, Maine. I would determine the rest from there. Resisting the temptation to goose-step in my new boots, I cut between bumpers and hurried across the road. The cordon of soldiers was gone from the front of the station. A weary porter was brushing up a mound of broken glass at the windows. I hurried past him into the building. No inspector asked to see my ticket. The restaurant was starting to fill back up, a queue already forming at the counter. I followed the signs out past the waiting room. The first platform was empty. While I crossed the footbridge to the other side, the Lublin locomotive let out another long, mournful whistle beneath my feet. At the far end of the track, the chimney pumped a dark plume that spiraled to a taper. Men skidded along the platform and dived into open carriages, officers at the front in first class, soldiers at the rear. About to descend the final flight of stairs, I paused as heavy footsteps clanged across the walkway behind me. Someone shouted, "Hey, wait!" I could do nothing but flatten myself against the wall as the soldiers raced past, shoving each other and giggling. One of them called out, "Stop that train!" I followed them down through a fog of hissing steam on the platform to the rear of the train, as far from the officers' quarters as I could get. In second class, I stood less chance of being recognized, or not being recognized, whichever was worse. With the engine goading the wheel pistons into motion, I gripped the handles of the last open carriage and hurled myself in. The lion's den resembled a debauched Kiel dormitory after finals. Except my enemy wore Wehrmacht uniforms, not waistcoats and blazers. Almost all were drunk. A few soldiers had passed out, stripped naked, dead to the world. The rest had been enjoying the station's facilities while the train was fixed, and had scrambled back as the whistle blew. I found myself squashed on a corner bench with a group sharing a bottle of vodka. Red-nosed and emboldened, the lad at my elbow turned with a wink and ventured, "Checking up on us, sir?"
"Something like that," I said.
"Where are your men?" I pointed vaguely to the snaking carriages ahead, but the lad mistook my gesture and placed the vodka in my hand, closing my fingers gently around the bottle. His friends cheered when I took a swig.
"Thanks," I said, gulping. "Needed that."
Handing it back, I closed my eyes, savoring the spirit's deep, intestinal glow. I sat wedged against the wall in darkness as the train left the station and chugged toward Lublin, Maine. When I was certain the soldiers had forgotten about me, I allowed my hand to roam the pockets of my new uniform, taking an inventory. One box of Nordland cigarettes, unopened, and a smooth silver lighter heavy as a pebble. the salvaged wallet, empty except for Harry Monka's identification card, my prayer shawl. That was it for the trousers. I loosened a button on the tunic and dug inside the breast pocket, where a square of paper rustled, and something hard dug into my skin when I pressed. Brass shell casing or a pen lid? The object was concealed in an envelope, but there was a second letter behind it that I unfolded first, since it was already open. A military form, authorizing 54 hours of compassionate leave for Oberführer Harry Monke to attend his brother's funeral in the family home of Dama, near the Polish border. Today was the second of a 4-day pass. The envelope contained a long door key and the transferred title deeds of an apartment in Krakow on the corner of Traguta and Dąbrowskiego that had belonged to Erik Monke, the deceased brother. I knew the area well. Podgórze was just outside the Jewish ghetto, less than 3 miles from where my mother and sister had lived, their last known place of residence. 2. 5 hours and 3 kilometers later, I arrived at Krakow Główny, or Hauptbahnhof Krakow, as the proliferation of scarlet and black drapes now proclaimed. The station had been Nazified. I knew the feeling. Navigating the busiest transportation hub in the administrative capital of occupied Poland was not the smartest move for a Jew in a murdered SS officer's uniform. But now I was here, I had no choice but to keep moving. Summoning Monka's arrogance at Lublin, I barreled through the crowd towards the exit and set off south, toward Podgórze on foot. High above the banks of the Vistula, Wawel Castle was now called Krakauer Burg, the entrance's bronze likeness of Tadeusz Kościuszko on rearing horseback, replaced by Governor Hans Frank's huge black Cadillac. Not even a German car for this stalwart of National Socialism. The pretender king and his queen Beatrice rode around like movie stars. Meanwhile, Polish civilians were banned from visiting their ancestral seat of the castle now, except for construction workers and cleaners. At the northern edge of Old Town, the Battle of Grunwald, that great turning point of medieval history when Poles and Lithuanians united to defeat the Teutonic Knights of 1410, was no longer commemorated by an enormous plinth. 529 years later, the knights roared back, riding panzer tanks, obliterating all trace of Polish independence. My mother's last letter had warned off this rampant destruction, but I was still shocked. After Grunwald and Wawel, it had been Adam Mickiewicz's turn. What had a romantic poet ever done to the Nazis? German police cordoned off this monument at noon on the 17th of August, 1940, in the Rinnick, the old market square, and the vandals moved in with scaffolds and tools. They set about tearing off the allegorical figures from Mickiewicz's feet, as if motherland, science, courage, and poetry were street sluts to be whipped. Grown men cried out in the gathered crowd. Amateur photographers were beaten and arrested. Many of the assembled citizens did not know Adam Mickiewicz from the Old Testament Adam, but they came to understand the poet that day, after he was toppled. In being struck down, Mickiewicz became more powerful than the Germans could ever imagine. Within 48 hours, black market photos of his falling monument were selling quicker than cigarettes. 2 years later, one solitary soldier had been posted in Adolf Hitler plots to keep dissenters from turning the spot into a shrine. He saluted as I strode past. A few seconds later, I realized he was saluting me. While Johann Goethe's Faust had once professed a desire to reroute the Rhine to encircle Wittenberg, the Nazis had been as yet unable to alter the flow of the Vistula, which still snaked around Kazimierz as lazily as I remembered. The island's Jews were gone, unceremoniously dumped in a ghetto across the river. Erik Monke's apartment was situated in a leafy Podgórze neighborhood just northeast of the ghetto, a stone's throw from its prison walls. For now, I tried not to think of the squalor and misery within, lest the mask slip and my emotions betray me. There were many more German soldiers on patrol south of the river than the isolated clusters I'd glimpsed in Old Town. After the shock of seeing streets full of uniforms, I became appreciative of the camouflage they provided. Who would notice one more SS? Thankfully, no one did. Head held high, I crossed the road to Traugutta Street, the corner of Dambroskiego. I had survived my first hour in the city. Stopping opposite 65, I turned out the envelope from my pocket and studied the apartment's transfer deeds. I ruled out the possibility that Harry Munke's brother was married or had children. Any beneficiaries would have inherited the property, not his brother. But that did not necessarily mean Eric lived alone. According to the paperwork, the apartment was number 3E. I scanned the brick wall up to the third balcony. A good sign, the curtains were drawn, no lights on. I crossed the road and unlocked the front door. The lobby was dank and musty. To my right was a wall of labeled letter slots. Munke Eric was not hard to find. His was the only slot bulging with mail. I removed several weeks' worth of envelopes. There was an elevator, but I didn't relish being stuck inside the cage with a curious busybody. The staircase was at the rear. What I could not see from the letter racks was the proximity of the janitor's kitchen, tucked away behind the stairwell. I hurried past the open door, but it was too late. A chair squeaked on linoleum, and the ancient janitor was hobbling towards me, a rolled newspaper clutched in his liver-spotted hand.
"Hey, stop there!"
Dim eyes focused on my uniform, the stripes on my shoulder. His glower lifted like a summer fog.
"Oh, please forgive me. Heil Hitler. How can I help you, sir?"
I stepped towards him, palm extended. "Harry Munke."
"Harry?"
His hand went limp in mine. "Eric's brother."
"I was so sorry to hear the news."
"You must be Mr.—" I wagged a finger next to my head.
"Escherich. Bela Escherich."
"That's right. Eric mentioned your name."
"Your brother was a hero, Oberfuhrer Munke. Those Warsaw ghetto rats should be exterminated. Instead, they talk about sending them to Madagascar."
"Thank you. We are all very proud of Eric. The funeral was most touching."
"There have been so many sacrifices of late."
"We are gaining ground," I said. "There is a real momentum. I predict our victory early next year."
"I didn't mean to suggest your brother's death was in vain."
"Of course not. Forgive me, I'm quite shattered."
"Please."
Escherich pointed his newspaper to the stairs. I turned away, then stopped. "No visitors I should know about, I trust?"
"Everything's just as it was, sir."
"Good. And not that I'm expecting anybody, but I would appreciate keeping my arrival quiet until tomorrow at least." He tapped the side of his nose and grinned.
"In that case, for the sake of appearances, you may wish to leave a few letters in Eric's rack."
I peeled off a handful and handed them over.
"May I ask how long you intend to stay, sir?"
"Tomorrow."
"Probably for the best."
"No," I said. "We'll talk about my plans tomorrow."
"Oh, yes."
"Good night, Bella." The third floor hallway reeked of boiled cabbage, peppered with the tang of fresh vomit. There was a bundled bedsheet outside the door of my neighbor's apartment, upon which a note had been pinned. "Apologies for the smell. Sick child. Please stay away." I kicked the sheet along to the end of the corridor and left it outside my door to deter well-wishers. I knocked, loud enough to raise an army. The only sense of movement I was aware of came from behind me. My neighbor was at the peephole, studying the back of my head. Resisting every urge to spin and glare, I guided the trembling key into the lock and turned. The hallway was hot and narrow, two doorways in the opposite wall and a further two at each end, front and back. All were shut, except for the kitchen, where the door panel had been removed from the hinges. It was a sad, otherwise unventilated space, with only one worktop and no table. Next door was a tiny bathroom where a man could urinate, shave, and fill the tub without breaking into a stretch. The back room contained Eric's bed, desk, and wardrobe. A spare uniform hung from the pole, a few tailored shirts and ties, a smart gray suit, two pairs of shoes underneath. The shelf above the clothes held a brown leather suitcase. I was about to place the old lady's prayer shawl inside when I stopped. I cursed my lack of foresight. What if Harry Munke had luggage on his train? For a 2-day visit, he must have taken a case, but then failed to collect it at Lublin. The porters would have found a bag by now. It could be gathering dust in the lost property office. Worst case scenario, if Harry used luggage labels, an enterprising porter had already alerted the authorities. I found a telephone in the front room, dialed the operator, and asked to be connected to Lublin Hauptbahnhof, where I gave my rank and explained my forgetfulness, blaming it on the preoccupied state following my brother's funeral. The clerk was most sympathetic, but didn't know anything about a case. He promised to call me back as soon as possible. I could do nothing except to tremble and perspire. Even controlling my breath proved grueling, and I feared I might pass out. Eventually, I managed to persuade my lungs to inflate beyond the dimensions of a pea, and the dizziness passed. My new life, if that's what this turned out to be, would be fraught with fear from one minute to the next. If I could not learn to live with it, I may as well end it now. 30 minutes later, the telephone rang, startling me from silent contemplation. It was the clerk. Harry's suitcase had been handed in to Lost Property. "That's excellent news," I sighed, and surely never had a man sounded more relieved.
"There's just one slight problem, Oberfuhrer. According to the label, the final destination was not Krakow."
"You're right. I forgot to write a new one after the funeral."
"I hope you forgive the intrusion, Oberfuhrer, but for the sake of security, I must ask you to confirm the original destination on that label."
"Of course," I said, playing for time. I had forgotten the name of the city where they'd buried Erich Munke. All I could think of was that it began with a D. Dornberg, Dornstadt, Dornstetten.
"The name of the city, sir?"
"Oh, right, yes. You need to hear it from me, don't you? Dresden, Dachau, Dortmund. I was waiting to hear it from you."
"The other way round would be preferable."
"Otherwise, I could have confirmed anything you said."
"Exactly. To make sure your suitcase doesn't get into the wrong..."
"Dahme."
"I'm sorry?"
"My brother was buried in Dahme."
A pause.
"Thank you very much, sir. Your case will be on the first train to Krakow tomorrow morning. Can I assist you with anything else?"
I curled into Erich Munke's bed and slept the sleep of the dead. The next morning, I decided to return to Izaka Street as Josef Ziegler and seek out any original neighbors who had known my family. It was 6 months since Shoshana had taken my mother to a friendly farm outside Krakow, from where they had hoped to leave for Palestine. She hadn't revealed the name of the village in her letter, for obvious reasons. I had no way of knowing if they were still holed up in the countryside, if they had managed to escape, or if their plan, like so many others, had failed. I left Harry Munke's uniform in the wardrobe and dressed in cotton shirt and woolen trousers. For the first time in daylight, I opened the bedroom curtains to assess the lay of the land. At the foot of the building was a maze of vegetable gardens, sheds, and workshops. The area was bordered by an empty plot of land on one side, and across Traguta Street by a new-looking wall that extended in both directions at a length of several meters, and didn't seem to be guarding much except a nest of grim tenements, crooked as tombstones. When I followed the barricade round to the east as far as I could, I saw the curious sight of a large concrete grate in the middle of the wall, through which a rail train emerged, loaded with glum passengers. I had inherited a room with a prime view of the Jewish ghetto. Izaka could wait another hour. The janitor was changing the light bulb on a tottering ladder when I got downstairs. I stood gripping the side rail as he worked.
"I trust you found the sleep you are looking for, Mr. Munke."
"It was a little odd lying in my brother's bed, but tiredness soon got the better of me."
"In that respect, I envy you. The older I get, the more tired I become. But now I can't sleep. God's nothing if not a joker."
"I was looking at the allotments under the bedroom window. Did Erich have a plot?"
"Not much of a green fingers, your brother. He couldn't even keep a spider plant. I ended up adopting it myself."
"That sounds like Erich. Do you mind if I take a look?"
"'That is plant?'
"'The allotments,' I said. With a final twist, the light bulb flickered, casting Escherich's gaunt face a...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?